SMU, and they have a debate team, and we want to bring them up, particularly Rachel Buchanan and her coach, Stacey Sharones, for a brief announcement.
Well, hi, you guys. My name is Rachel Buchanan, and I am a student, an undergraduate.
I'm sorry.
There you go.
Is this better?
That's better, yes.
Okay, my name is Rachel Buchanan, and I'm an undergraduate student at SMU. I'm actually a philosophy and psychology double major, and these are two of my teammates. We are part of the SEED team, which stands for Society for Ethical Evaluation and Debate, and we go and compete in different ethics roles. We've actually recently become a new student organization. Last year we made it to nationals, and this year we've gone back to regionals, made it to nationals again. But because we're still in the process of becoming an organized, like a new student organization, we have very limited funding for the trip. So, my colleagues and I are here to have a symbiotic relationship. We want to, go to nationals on March 1st in Cincinnati, Ohio, and we're, scraping the bottom of the barrel, trying to get funds together, trying to prepare for these really intense cases on different applied ethics. The topics range from one of our cases on the ethics of the assassination of Osama bin Laden, and some of our other cases are about animal rights, and just really a variety of different ethics and ethical issues that arise. So we are having a practice competition to go over some of the cases on February 23rd at SMU. And I have a sign-up sheet if anyone's interested in attending and listening to our cases and our theories and would like to help us better prepare our cases. We would really appreciate it. If you give us your email address, we can send it out. And I'm going to actually pass it on to my fellow teammates.
Okay. Hello, I'm Meredith. I'm a sophomore at SMU, and I'm actually not a philosophy major. I'm an English and art history major, but I really enjoy participating in SEED because it gives me a chance to branch out and learn different things that I don't learn in my classes currently. I'm just going to tell you real quick about the competitions. So last year, I believe it was in October, we competed in regionals in St. Mary's University, and we placed third out of 30 schools, I think so. Yes.
Bravo.
Hi, thank you. It was definitely a challenge, so we're looking forward to going to nationals, which is in Cincinnati, like she said. And I believe there are 12 cases, correct? And we divided them up amongst our team, and we look forward to competing. So here's Natalie.
Hello, I'm a junior at SMU, and I'm actually not a philosophy major either. I'm an anthropology and religious studies major. I enjoy SEED a lot because I didn't really ever get to hear any of the philosophy or experience any of that, and SEED has given me the opportunity to, like, know those different ways of thinking, and I think it's really important, and I take it into a lot of my other classes, and I can see, like, the theories coming out in my anthropology or my religious studies, and I think it's really meaningful to be on campus. But we've been working really hard on our cases, and I just really would love any support that you guys have, whether that's coming to our practice rounds and maybe coaching us on any ideas that you think would just really advance us, or what about that baby? Thanks again for having us. I'm finishing my doctorate at SMU, and I've taught a few undergraduate classes, and it's nothing like coaching this team, because these students want to be there, they want to be learning about philosophy, they're dedicated, they are, all we have, Rachel just became a philosophy major this year, so we've actually converted her. But it's so rewarding, and these students, I mean, they're just really the cream of the crop, the best of the best. A delight to work with them. And any way you want to support them or get involved with us, it would be terrific. So thanks again for having us here.
Okay, so if you haven't already paid, please do so immediately after the lecture. Jack Youngkin, our treasurer, it's $5, and as students with an ID, it's $2. And if you want to be a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months, so that's quite a bargain. And then also remind you to make sure you pay your tab after the dinner, after the speech. Foster Swarm is a not-for-profit organization, and we are not in a position to pay for people's dinners, so we appreciate that. We also have a website that has a lot of this information about the Dallas Foster Swarm and our upcoming speeches and presentations. And you can also sign up for our email list to get on our email directory. And so we can give you notifications of the different speeches and events that are coming up in the future. And so now I'd ask you to please turn your cell phones off or put them on vibrate mode at this time. I'd now like to introduce our speaker. Dr. David Alkink is a cosmetic dermatologist in the Dallas area. He's worked on my face, and how do I look? In addition to his medical expertise, Dr. Alkink has a keen interest in philosophy, cosmology, and history. And he's the author of several books, including The Self-Creating Universe, available on Amazon, right, David? And his newest, Fatal Philosophy, which has got a really gory, fascinating cover to it. His topic today is the meaning of life through Eastern perspectives. We also want to welcome his Valentine Sharman in the red.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And now please join me in welcoming David Alkink.
Well, I'm really flattered that so many people have come out here on Valentine's Day. I have a couple of announcements. I'm a member of the Dallas-Fort Worth Writers Group. Can you hear me?
A little louder.
Keep going. Just keep talking.
All right. And they're having a conference, a writers' conference, for those who are writers or would-be writers or want to go to a workshop. Here's some handouts for y'all if you're interested. And the other thing is that because this is Valentine's Day, and I'm really flattered that you would come and leave your Valentine home, or that you would bring your Valentine to this lovely restaurant, here's some Valentine's candy. Take one and take it home to your Valentine. I hope there's enough. For the students here, this subject is not going to be esoteric or philosophically pedantic, you know. I'm going to try to make it so that everybody can enjoy it. It's a small subject, the meaning of life, that everybody can relate to. And I noticed that since we're going to do this on Eastern perspectives, that I don't know if y'all have the schedule for the rest of the year, but there's going to be a couple more on Eastern stuff. On March 13th, the Vedanta, the Hindu perspective, and April the 24th, exploring contemporary thoughts in Buddhist philosophy. So I guess I'm in good company. All right. So what do we mean by, quote, the meaning of life? What do we mean by the meaning of the meaning of life? We're talking about the definition of meaning in this context as significance, like that Vietnam Memorial has meaning for me. What is its significance? Does life have meaning in the first place? What is it beyond our mere existence that gives our lives significance? If some lives have significance and are more meaningful than others, whose may be meaningless, then what makes a life worth living? What makes some lives more meaningful than others? So why do we even ask this question in the first place? And there are two dimensions to this. One is the personal dimension or individual one. You know, what is the meaning of my life as it relates to, do I want to live my life as a life of reason or a life of faith, to be part of nature, to be independent as a member of society? How does it relate to me? And the other part of the dimension is the collective or social one. What is our relationship to others? How do I fit in larger groups and society and the broader world in general? So these are the things that we need to think about, and now I'm going to kind of explore what Eastern perspectives on this is. And I'm going to start with the Hindu perspective as seen in the Bhagavad Gita. You've probably heard that phrase, that term, or writing. What does it mean? Gita is song, or poem, or it's a kind of a paean. Bhagavad Gita means the song of the Lord. What's the background is that this prince, Arjuna, is in conflict with his 100 cousins, he and his three brothers, for the kingdom. He's at war with these relatives. And so he comes to the field of battle goes out with his chariot into the field to kind of look at the combatants, the enemy. And he sees his cousins, his friends, his teachers, his uncles, his relatives. And he says, oh my gosh, I'm going to war with them. I'm going to be killing my family. His charioteer happens to be Krishna, who's an incarnation of God. And Vishnu and Krishna says, look. And he talks to him. And the whole Gita is about this conversation. That it is your duty. You need to see yourself in the context of what this is all about. And so the metaphor is, you know, we're on this field of sacred duty, okay? And in which we got to work it out. Everyone, every day, does battle in the domain that we have to make important choices. And these choices are between myself and my individual, what I want to do, and a higher duty. Between individual desire and understanding our place in the universe. And we often have duties peculiar to our station in life. Student, teacher, doctor, lawyer, whatever. And our own personal duty may conflict with larger duties, ethical duties, what society needs and wants. So these make us have an existential choice. Arjuna, the prince, is deeply torn between his duty as a warrior and a leader and his duty to his family. So between justice for his cause and imperative to make peace, he will gain a kingdom at the price of killing his cousins and friends. So you see, these are existential choices. We're constantly faced with these and genuine conflicts in our lives between important values. And to fail to take these conflicts seriously is to act in bad faith. If we don't understand how to make choices, we can't make meaning out of our life. So this says now that we are the authors of our actions. We are responsible for ourselves. And the idea of a meaningful life is then under our control. Krishna tells Arjuna to focus on what's permanent, what's here. You know, what's not just here and gone tomorrow. On the universe, on enduring values. Focus on large issues, large things. Our duties come to us by virtue of our station in life, like I told you, and so we can't shirk them. There's much in our lives we can't control, but we can control what we do, how we react to them. So in making choices, we need to focus on our actions and not worry about the consequences over which we have no control. And they use the metaphor of the arrow, and so do the Zen Buddhists, that as you pull your bow with your arrow, you have control what you aim at. But as soon as you let the arrow go, you have lost control over it. If the wind takes it somewhere, if a child runs in front of the arrow, you have no control over that. So focus on what you have control over, and don't worry about the consequences that you don't. So what genuine control comes from discipline. So discipline is the key to freedom. The central teaching of the Gita is that genuine human freedom comes through discipline, not through release from discipline. And they speak of three different kinds of disciplines or yogas. A yoga is related to our word yoke, and it's kind of a discipline, a way. The three kinds they talk about, the discipline of action, a discipline of knowledge, and a discipline of devotion. And this is what Krishna is teaching or telling Arjuna, all these things. And so I'm telling you as if he was speaking, okay? So the discipline of action means action is essential, and we have choices for our action, okay? This is what I just told you. But this must be supplemented by knowledge. I mean, action can be going out and robbing a bank, but, you know, not right. So you have to have the correct knowledge, the discipline of knowledge. And that enables us to make the right decisions from our understanding of the world. Now, this has to be in the context, he says, of the discipline of devotion, which means surrendering your own personal goals to the order of the cosmos. And you can put deity into that if you want to. You have certain duties because of your station in life. And like I said, you can't shirk those duties. There's much we can't control, but we can control that. So we also see that our individual actions are connected to something bigger, something to the cosmos as a whole. And recognizing our connection to the larger whole then gives our lives significance. Only by thinking of each action in relation to them can we make our lives more than a minor temporary distraction in the history of the universe. Okay, so have you seen images of the Hubble telescope?
Oh, yeah.
And you realize these galaxies that are millions of light years, billions of light years away, huge galaxies, huge universe that we live in, but we're a member of it, and we're a small member of it. But still, it is our task, because we're a member of this larger whole, to find meaning of our lives in that context. So just like you're a member of a sports team, or a family, or an organization, or the city of Dallas, and the universe, you can be a good team player, and a really large team, the only really one that matters. So happiness comes from internal, not external causes. You're the author of it. You are in charge of it. The Gita shows a method of self-control that leads to peace in our uncertain world, regardless of success or failure. So concentrate on what you're doing. You can do it right if you live right. Don't be concerned with the consequences. So the Gita is about the value of an active life, not an ascetic or a contemplative one. Withdrawing from action is still a deliberate act. Not choosing something is still a choice. So the source of evil or bad karma is passion and desire, not necessarily from the action itself. Do what you must do regardless of distraction or reward or success or failure. Think of it this way. An athlete who's at the Olympics, going to be a broad jump or a 100-yard dash or whatever, he's got to concentrate on what he's doing, not his not his fellow, not who he's competing with, not, you know, but he's got to focus on his action. An actor or a public speaker, same way. You've got to concentrate on what you're doing, on your delivery. Look at me. taking a test, applying for a job, you know, get the extraneous things out of the way, concentrate on what you're doing. A surgeon, I mean, if the surgeon's concerned about, you know, the ticket he had yesterday, he's not going to do a very good job. So that's the lesson of the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. I'm going to go to a different country now, China, and talk about the Confucian perspective. Master Kung, that we call Confucius, is a Latinization of Master Kung Tzu, Kung Fu Tzu, lived around 500 BC. And his emphasis is not like the Gita, but on everyday life, on the life in a social context. The social context of our lives. It's a social philosophy concerned with society. Some important philosophical ideas of Confucianism, and I'm going to go through these Chinese forms here. Ren, which means humanity or warm-heartedness, generosity, being a human, being a mensch. Li, which is propriety, correctness, ritual. De, virtue, honesty, integrity, moral correctness. Jiao is filial piety, respect for your elders, for family, for authority. Qian, the nature or order or of the universe, and the Chinese refer to that as heaven. They don't say God, but they say heaven or the mandate of heaven. But that's the order of the universe. And wu wei, or spontaneity or effortlessness, that is kind of like total professionalism, doing things kind of effortlessly. In Confucianism, the ideal cultured person develops humanity, virtue, moral correctness, and ritual propriety. Confucianism aims to cultivate individual excellence in a social context. The achievement of good character is through training and practice and eventually becomes effortless. So this then produces a well-ordered family, which translates to a harmonious society, which then reflects the cosmic order. So the emphasis is on ordinary, everyday, social, interpersonal organization. The good life, like the Gita, Confucianism emphasizes our specific roles in the family and society. So these are our roles, this is what you should do. A good life is ritualized, beautiful, aesthetic, yet acted out hopefully spontaneously in an effortless way. That's the Confucian way. The Taoist perspective takes an opposite point of view. It says that Confucianism that says that culture is a part of nature is bunk, that culture and Confucianism get in the way. They inhibit our natural state. And Tao means a way, the way. And we're talking about the way of life, the way you should live, but also the way of the universe, the big way, okay? So the way of life lived in harmony with the universal way, to return to a natural state free of cultural accretions. It calls for a spontaneous living, kind of emphasis on nature, not culture. The Tao is also a Tao of thought and speech, as well as the way we should live. So they say that we attribute value to things in the world that have no intrinsic value. Money, objects, position, whatever. We put value on them, but they don't have any value. Money doesn't have a value, it's a piece of paper. we put value on. These values or qualities are projections of our own desires, and these projections distance us from reality. Values such as good and bad, ugly and beautiful, opposites like that, have no significance by themselves, but only in relation to something else. Something's not good unless you have bad to compare with it, ugly with beautiful, etc. And we impute those. We give values to those. You can't have one without comparing to another. And so sometimes words get in our way. They trap us into thinking that they're a reality, but they're really our own projections. Words are not permanent, but they change. Values change. So we have to cut away things sometimes and not add more to it. Often, the Taoists say, doing something right is doing something is the right thing to do, but sometimes not to do anything at all. The universe is permanent, not you. It doesn't care about you. It is not rational or benevolent. So let go of your concerns. We can't just focus on ourselves, on our own concerns, but have to pay attention to the social context in which we live. So the three Taoist principles are: live in harmony with the universe, embrace permanence, that impermanence, that is death, that you're mortal, that you have, you know, finitude, and so come to grips with that, and appreciate the human versus the cosmic scale. So get down to earth, be natural, live a natural life. Okay, let's go back to India. About the same time, Siddhartha Gautama, was a prince, and he became the Buddha. I guess everybody's familiar with that, so I'm not going to get into how he did it. But anyway, he left the princely life and sat under the Bodhi tree until he became enlightened. And when he became enlightened, he realized what the value, the values of life and how to get away from suffering are. And so the three fundamental ideas of Buddhist philosophy and teaching are this. Number one, impermanence. Two, selflessness. And three, interdependence. What do I mean by those big words? Impermanence. All things and phenomena are impermanent. Two kinds of impermanence. Gross impermanence. Things age and get old and die. They go through change. Die over time. And then there's subtle impermanence. Everything constantly changes from minute to minute. Over the last hour or so, some of the cells in my skin died. Okay? Some of my blood cells died. My hair falls out. Same thing with all of you. And over the next few weeks, everything will sort of change. Number two, selflessness. So we're constantly changing everything. Not solid things don't persist. Selflessness. Selflessness are in two types. The selflessness of the person, because we're constantly changing, we have no permanent identity. We have no self, you might say. That's what the Buddha says. And then the selflessness of phenomenon. Things are constantly changing and have no permanent identity. You know, this family had George Washington's hatchet that he cut down the cherry tree with. And it had been passed down in their family for, you know, generations and generations. And you talk to them and they said, "You still have this hatchet?" "Oh yeah, we still have that George Washington hatchet, you know. The handle broke two or three times, so we replaced the handle. And the metal part, it rusted, and so we had to replace it too. But we still have the hatchet." It's not the original hatchet, is it? It's changed. Okay. And interdependence of everything in the universe. Three different kinds. Causal interdependence, which means everything happens because of causes and conditions. Something causes this, something caused that, which causes this, etc. And then what do I do? What I do now causes something else, conditioned upon it. Mariological, which means that the whole is dependent on the parts, and the parts are dependent on the whole. I have a car. I can take the steering wheel out, and I can take the brakes out. And here's the steering wheel, and here are the brakes. But they're not the car. Okay. I have to put them all together. And the car is not the brakes and the steering wheel either. It's everything. So the parts are not good unless they're in the car, and the car is not good without its parts. So they both rely on each other. And then conceptual imputation. So we make an identity for everything by putting them in conceptual categories. So we make a concept of this, of the table, of that. And so we impute concepts to it. So we make it artificial, sort of that way. Okay. So then come the Four Noble Truths. The ancients like to say the four this and the five that and the seven this because that's easy to remember. Just like epics were in poems, the Homer's Odyssey and Iliad were recited in poetry. The Bible was kind of recited in a sing song. So that you can remember it that way and pass it on orally. So the Four Noble Truths, and they're not noble because they're truths. They're named that way to make you noble, or to think nobly. So we have four of those. Now, the first one is all is suffering, and suffering is universal. Three kinds of suffering. Gross pain and unpleasantness. You know, you hurt, got a broken leg. You get sick, you die. Suffering caused by constant change. You get older, you die. And then suffering because of conditioning, because we live in a world of uncertainty, where causes and conditions are out of our control. So we can't control that, and that's kind of a source of suffering for us. Desire is a cause of suffering. The desire can be attraction to something. I want money, I want a Mercedes-Benz, or aversion. I don't like those kind of people, Democrats or, you know, whatever. So it can be either way. These are caused by confusion, primal confusion, basic ignorance. So inability to recognize that things are impermanent and interdependent. And letting go of desire can minimize or eliminate suffering. So we have then release from suffering is to eliminate primal ignorance. And we've got to realize that we can't eliminate pain. We can't eliminate, you know, I'm going to get older. We can't eliminate suffering. But we can have elimination of our confusion about these things and about ourselves. And so the prescription for removing this confusion is the Eightfold Path. And you've probably heard of this, you know, write this, write that. There are three basic domains. Action, that is ethical conduct, thought, achieving wisdom, and mindfulness or mental development. Under action, right livelihood, right speech. Under thought, right views, right meditation. And under mindfulness, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Buddhism is the middle way, called the middle way. And they refer to it that way is because between asceticism or, you know, just like Jainism, you know, being completely ascetic and away from this world, rejecting the world, and materialism or gross materialism itself. So it's kind of the middle way. Buddhism is very much attuned to psychology, how the mind works. Intentions matter a lot. Birth, death, rebirth, suffering come from ignorance, that there is a self that has permanence. We went through that. So doing good to others weakens the whole of egoism and selfish desire. Buddhists don't see the problem as sin or pride as we do in Western religion, but a matter of ignorance. We just don't know. The solution then is knowledge, understanding the causes of suffering and how to stop it. It's very practical. Once you recognize the cause of suffering and you remove it, then you're happy. So Buddhism is very logical, systematic, practical. The Buddha said, don't believe something just because you heard it from a teacher or a holy man or authority or you read it in scripture. You need to try it out for yourself. So we can't get rid of pain or change or aging and death, but we can get rid of the suffering they bring by removing this primal confusion about these things and about ourselves. So the Buddha is like a physician. The Four Noble Truths, number one, the symptoms. You first recognize the types and causes of suffering. Number two, the diagnosis. Desire is the cause of suffering. Number three, you outline the treatment. Then you find release from suffering. We eliminate the primal ignorance. And then we have the prescription, the Eightfold Path. So, very logical to eliminate the confusion. Three domains of life in which we need to solve the problems. I told you about the Eightfold Path. Action, right livelihood. The way we make a living kind of alters our lives. So don't be a drug dealer. You know, you are, you can't be a very good person. Right propriety, be polite, honest, decent. That makes you more effective. Right speech, tell the truth, not lies. Say what's useful. Talk about what's not useful. About, you know, gossip. Right views. Understand impermanence. Sure. Things change. You're not going to be here forever. Selflessness and interdependence in order to eliminate suffering. Right meditation. It's not enough to just think about it theoretically. You've got to settle in. You've got to think about it. Meditate on it. And right effort, you've got to do it. Don't just think about it. Right concentration, think about what you do and say and think, make it conscious. And right mindfulness, you must be mindful of it from moment to moment. So how do I do these things? You do it for 1 second, then you do it for the next second, then you do it for the next second, then you do it for the next. And so that's how you avoid your life. Okay, a Buddhist sage, Shantideva, kind of expanded on this, and he was what they call a bodhisattva. And he says that a bodhisattva is what we should all aim at, is a person who becomes awakened, or a Buddha, but instead of going off into nirvana, stays behind and helps other people through compassion to achieve awakening. He stresses mindfulness, that you can't control the world, but you can control how you react to it. So, the world is full of glass and rocks and nails and stones and whatever. Now, we have a choice. We can either cover the world with a big piece of leather to walk on, or we can put shoes on ourselves and walk on. So, it's a matter of looking at it the right way. So he says, when we look at other lives and ask what is the most meaningful, we don't pick the one that's the most sordid, the most selfish. We pick the one that's the most beneficial to others. So in order to do this, there are like four things here. First, we cultivate virtue. What do I mean? Living right. That makes our lives peaceful, meaningful, beneficial. We must cultivate an insight to see things the way they really are. Then we can see things that have to be done and to do them. The second perfection is that of mindfulness. That's part of the Eightfold Path. This is deeply moral to keep us focused on the virtues that we intend to cultivate. Our suffering is caused mainly by our own mental attitude. And for that reason, We can lead better lives, not by transforming the world around us, but by transforming our minds. In other words, we don't have to cover the world with leather, but our own shoes. Okay, so focus on what you can control, back to the Gita, what you can do. Perfection of patience. Self-transformation is hard, so you must cultivate patience with yourself. You must overcome your anger, because it's destructive. And the way to do that is to think about it and cultivate patience, which requires mindfulness, meditation, and wisdom. And cultivate wisdom. We can really become awakened when we do that. This leads to engagement with the universe as interdependent, selfless, impermanent, a spontaneous engagement that allows compassionate action. Okay, now, when Buddhism left India and kind of migrated into China, it met Taoism. And the result of this kind of marriage between Taoism and Buddhism is Zen Buddhism. We're familiar with that. In China, it's called Chan, where it was first. And then as it went to Japan, it was the Japanese called it Zen. And we're familiar in this country through the Japanese experience. Zen emphasizes a direct experience and meditation as opposed to the study of sacred scriptures or texts. There's no dependence on words or scripture, but a direct communication with the mind, person to person, mind to mind. In their tradition, each master got it from the master before him back to the Buddha himself. So as it passed on from master to master, person to person, mind to mind, that's their tradition. So seeing into one's own nature is to attain enlightenment. A fully awakened life, a life worth leading, is a life in which you understand your own nature and your own mind. Then you will be awakened. So in Zen, it's important to use nonverbal ways to do this. Art, poetry, flower arrangement, gardening. You do this in a way in which you get in touch with yourself, your inner self, and then you can become enlightened. Impermanence is more important in Zen. Our mind is subtly impermanent also. Our thoughts change from moment to moment. You're not the person that you were when you came in this room, when I started this talk. Other things have entered your mind, started other thoughts and other processes going, so even that's changed. Your mind has changed. And because of our fear of death, we mask the experience of this impermanence. We put on a layer of words, thoughts, concepts, actions, creating a layer between ourselves and reality, between us and our own genuine experience, you know, this fear of impermanence. So we tend to suppress our awareness of death and the significance of our impermanence. Therefore, we live in a dream world that's meaningless, even though we have the reality of a beautiful impermanent world in front of us. What if it was sunny and 75 all day, every day? You get bored. Wouldn't you like some snow and some leaves falling and, you know, hot, you can go swimming and that's really, I mean, you know, variety is the spice of life. Each of us has the basic capacity to understand ourselves, they say, and the world, and so to live a fully awakened, spontaneous life. The goal of Zen practice, like all Buddhism, is to become fully awakened, to lead a life in awareness of who we are, what is our duty, who is around us, and to be mindfully effective for our lives to be fully meaningful. so much for ancient history. Let's get down into the 20th century. We're going to talk about Gandhi now. Mohandas Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, lived in India, of course. And he criticized modernity. He's called a post-modernist. What is that? What do I mean by that? He actually believed that Western-style liberalism and individual freedom then leads to capitalism, which leads to consumerism, which leads to accumulation of wealth and power, and subverts democracy. So democracy or liberalism has its own seeds of corruption there. He says he has a deep sense of justice, of course, and the importance of human rights and the obligation of government to respect those rights. He was very, very active politically and socially. So he says that we have a duty as a member of society to bring our society into line with values. So a meaningful life involves our discharge of that duty. For Gandhi, justice and public political duties are very important. He believes one should lead a, quote, supernormal life in alleviating suffering and bringing political liberation. This is the duty to engage in social and political activity. So don't complain about who's president or who's elected if you stay home and you didn't vote. So a life led in service and discipline connects us to something broader, to our fellow humans, to genuine equality. This is the kind of life that serves the highest good and for him is therefore the most meaningful. Okay, we're almost through. The Dalai Lama, the present Dalai Lama. And he kind of combines a classical philosophy or way of looking things, a modernist and a post-modernist thoughts. He holds the classical Buddhist ideas of interdependence, and especially social one. And he agrees that happiness or flourishing is the highest good, along with Aristotle. So that's his classical leanings. He holds the modernist views of secular, religious, and individual freedom, and the importance of science. And he actually said, if science disagrees with holy scriptures, you should believe science. That's pretty good for a holy man. He also agrees with the postmodernists that suffering and confusion come from consumer capitalism, mass advertising, drive to buy and own more things, sort of like Gandhi. Modern capitalism has brought suffering from attraction or aversion, like the Buddha said, to new heights. Advertising, mass media, mass culture push us to new sources of confusion and suffering. Advertising creates need and fear. Gosh, I don't have what she has or what he has. I need more stuff. Own more things. That sort of thing. And advertising pushes that, makes us feel, you know, like we don't have enough or we need more, etc. On the other hand, the social interaction can also be our source of happiness in interactions with family and friends. Happiness can only be attained in the context of social interdependence. It adds to our happiness so much because our happiness is social. It gives us the opportunity to work on social values and ideals and to lead a life of integrity. So we need to develop compassion and commitment to the creation of happiness. The Dalai Lama is very concerned with psychology, emotional pathology associated with attraction and aversion. Sometimes he says we mistake pathology for virtue, such as justified anger. What is that? You know, I'm angry, but I'm justified, you know, being angry at so-and-so. Even love or patriotism can be subverted, can be twisted and used in a wrong way. So the pathology of attachment can be greed or lust, feeling of terrible neediness or need for approval. These are pathologies of attachment. Pathologies of aversion would be hatred, racism, distaste, anger. Now, there can also be social dimensions. We could have a social or collective attachment. We don't like them. We are the insider, they're the outsiders, you know, we hate them, let's go to war. That would be the end result of it. So he says that the cultivation of compassion comes in two parts. We should cultivate restraint, and we should cultivate virtue. Restraint, holding back negative reactions such as anger, greed, carelessness. But even though restraint keeps us from doing bad things, by itself it doesn't motivate us to do what's right, what's necessary. So for that we need to cultivate generosity, a willingness to detach ourselves from our possessions, and to cultivate virtue, which requires patience, not only with ourselves, but others. And so to reflect on impermanence again, or things will pass away, so don't get attached to them. And selflessness, we have a habit of thinking of everything and everybody is related to ourselves, to me, my friend, my family, my country, my this, and my job, instead of, you know, how do I fit in the relationship to the world? We're not the center of the universe. The universe doesn't revolve around us. We're just a passing phenomenon. So take your own importance less seriously. He emphasizes a universal responsibility for the welfare of all, because there are no limits on compassion. The last person I'd like to talk about is Thich Nhat Hanh, and a lot of you may not be familiar with him. He's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who lived through the Vietnamese War, and it became very popular, has written several books. Was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I read a book of his, was given to me by a friend, No Death, No Fear. To him, he says, our life, is a continuation, or any life, is a continuation of birth, or coming into being, becoming manifest, being conscious, acting, speaking, then passing on into another manifestation. In other words, we have the genes, the traditions, the teachings, the words of our parents, and from them, their parents, their ancestors have been passed to us, okay? They're not truly dead. Likewise, we have inherited them, we add to them our experience and pass them on to our children. Not only our cultural things, our teachings, our words, our impressions of us as parents and our teachers, but also our genes. Our genes never die. They go on and they go on. So nothing is completely life when lost when life is over. Nothing is created out of nothing. Even the stars that you see out there that seem to be endless, infinite in time, they go through birth and life and death. But in their death, they explode and spew out those elements that are seeds for the next generation of stars. It's believed that our own sun is a third generation of stars that have been formed, novaed, reformed, etc. When a star, collapses, its elements go from hydrogen to helium to oxygen, nitrogen, but down to iron, to very heavy elements, and then it explodes. It goes out into the universe. That's seeds for the next star. But the heavier elements of which we're all made made of, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, etc., are only formed by dying stars. So we are indeed stardust. Thich Nhat Hanh says not to dwell on the past, for it's gone and can never be regained or repeated. You can't change it. You can't redo it. Let it go. Also, don't waste time thinking about the future, because it's determined by the present. It's determined by what you do now. So you can act only now and in this place. So always when there is stress or turmoil or indecision in your life, think you're in the here and now. And sometimes that has really been a source of peace for me, to say, be in the here and now. Don't worry about tomorrow or whatever, or so-and-so hurt me yesterday. Okay. So what is the meaning of life? Do I have the question? Do I have the answer? I have the question. Do I have the answer? What you see here is that that means the importance of a connection to something larger than me, something bigger. And that biggerness can be a deity, can be a universal or cosmic concept, can be a social concept, or can be a humanist. But something larger than me. And to understand how we can make our lives meaningful by connecting to that context, that's what's important. We must understand then that everything that we think and do, we're playing our part in a whole. Part, no man is an island. We must be aware of our own temporality or the impermanence of everything, to be aware of our own mortality. It says in Ecclesiastes, O Lord, teach me to number my days. Think of yourself as numbered days. And put yourself into a context of you're here for a finite period and to do what you have to do in that time, and that will give your life significance. Cultivate spontaneity. Actions and values should not be artificial, so return to a naturalness and live authentically. Understand the nature of the world and your own nature and face reality squarely. Be aware of your biologic nature, that you fit into the biosphere here. You're part of this island Earth. So a meaningful life entails freedom. Freedom comes from discipline. And we saw that released from social, religious, economic, and political constraints. Even philosophical ideas and intellectual traditions or religious traditions can suppress creativity. Consumerism and the desire to own more things also limits us. So, to end up, Joseph Campbell said, people say that we're all seeking meaning in life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking, he says. I think that what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive.
Thank you, Dave. We have time for questions in the audience?
Yes.
Bobby.
Excellent summary.
Oh, thank you.
Beautiful presentation. An awful lot of, well, good, positive. In fact, you put too good a positive view on a lot of these things that are very negative in the Eastern
community.
There's only one thing I want to talk about, but we can talk for 2 hours back and forth. And that is this concept in some of these people about denying one's desire, because my desire is what makes me human. My passion is what makes me. If I want meaning in my life, it's not out there. It's in here. I choose the meaning. So if you want to be happy, choose to be happy. I prefer to be satisfied than happy. You know, you can get yourself into, you know, all kinds of metaphysical and religious ideas that make you happy, but that's a dumb happy. You know, that's, you know, I don't know anything, so I'm happy. So all I'm saying is, there's a lot of lot of wisdom there, and you gave it too much positive. There's a lot of negativity in the East from you.
Yes.
Particularly the denial of desire, which makes us human.
Well, he's not saying to deny all desire, but to desire denial desire that gets in your way, that causes suffering. You know, it's good to desire sex, but you desire sex with the wrong person, it can get you in real trouble. So it's the wrong kind of desire, or the misplaced desire that does. And you're Epicurean, I know that. But the Buddhists do talk about selflessness, and the self is nothing, and you know, which I have trouble with, and I kind of glossed over that part. But still, it's kind of a very practical religion that you should aim for happiness, to be happy, and so that you will become aware and awakened as to what is truly good, ultimate reality.
There's good stuff there. I didn't think that. I just wanted to bring up that one.
Thank you, Robin. Lady, right here.
Oh, I was just going to say that my understanding about desire is the attachment to the desire. The desire becomes so strong and the attachment so strong that it's just the only thing you can see, and then it becomes a difficulty. So it isn't just desire, you know, you desire your motivator, but if it's the only thing, if you're going to be attached to it, I've got to have your love, you know, and you're the only one, that attachment, that's my mind.
Well, I have that concept, to me, between the extremes.
Okay, this gentleman right back here.
I want to ask a question, because it's always bothered me about Buddhism and a lot of these religions. I can't even believe that the progenitors of those religions ever really meant what it has been translated to, okay? And that is this kind of not just ultra-selflessness, but where you set yourself on fire like some of these Buddhist monks did during the Vietnam War. And it seems to me that, you know, those are which everyone would go by dying for his country, and one by making the other self-rich right for his country. And then when you look at the actual history of Buddhist monasteries, they had to develop various kinds of self-defense mechanisms in order to stop the Rwanda War and things like that. And just, it seems to me, if you don't like your opinion on it, go back to the original, like what they really said about justice and the concept of, first of all, standing up for yourself and protecting your own life, says just self-abnegation, and secondly, maybe even standing up for others, even if it's going to cost you something at a risk.
Over 2,500 years, Buddhism has gone through evolution, just like Christianity or Judaism or any Islam. All major religions have, and you get little, you know, this holy man, you know, preaches this, and this does this, and there are branches, and I didn't go into all that. What I wanted to do is kind of give a basic, you know, what the Buddha taught, you know, back, you know, what did Jesus say, what, you know, not what, you know, evolution of their religious or philosophical thought. You know, in the 20th century, yes, it's gone all different kinds of ways, but I didn't want to get into that.
Well, the reason I asked that was this. I went to this Baha'i church once, and I was curious about what they thought about going back to the origins, because one of the big themes is that most of the religions have the right idea, but they go off in these different paths.
Right.
And it seemed to me that certain kinds of Christians do that same kind of thing as self-abnegation. And Jesus himself, for example, said, go to the second mile. But you notice he didn't say third, fourth, fifth, things like that. Yeah. And I asked him about, what about Buddhism? Was there anything in Buddhism like that? Or maybe you do something to try to return love against hate, but there's a limit. And this guy said, I don't remember where I saw it, but I'm almost certain somewhere in one of these Buddhist texts I saw this, where they asked the Buddha, what do you do if somebody uses you hateful and tries to give you hate? He said, return love. And they said, well, that's a good idea, but what if even after you've done that, they continue to treat you hatefully? And he says that it actually said in the text that he leaned forward and said he returned it with firmness. So there's like a limit. It was like most of these original ideas were sexual, and they get kind of changed or mutated into these kind of self-abnegating philosophies where you set yourself on fire and, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Gandhi said that don't tell yourself, don't convince yourself that you have all the truth. You may meet somebody that's got, you know, a little different kind of truth or more truth or different than yours. He said, if I got this right, that truth is transcendent. And as you get it, you can't hold it in your open fist, but in your open hand for others to see also. So nobody's got all the truth. And we have bits and pieces in here and there. And we can get them all together.
Jack?
Yeah, so, David, it seems like I'm sort of in the Eastern thing. I'm hearing that a part of it is saying there's kind of a how you results of happiness.
Right.
And then maybe the Jiva says it's more like what you choose to do can make you happy. I'm just kind of wondering, you know, is it either or is it some, I mean, it seems like psychologically maybe there's a balance that might be required there, but I would certainly know that if I chose to do my duty, wherever it is, but what I really wanted to do was some kind of, you know, be a musician, and if I gave up being a musician because I wanted to do my duty, I'd be pretty happy.
Some people problems with the Gita and doing your duty. You know, during the Nuremberg trials, they, you know, tried these German officers and said, well, I was only doing my duty. It didn't matter if, you know, 6 million Jews were killed. I was doing what I was ordered. You know, I was doing my duty as a soldier. Well, you know, that's a wrong type thing. You know, if you're doing your duty in the concept of virtue and that sort of thing. So, yes, you're responsible. You are responsible for your action. You're responsible for your duty. What and Aristotle is the same thing. You know, what's the source of happiness or eudaimonia? You know, doing these things, friendships and that sort of thing, social, whatever. I didn't get into a Christian type of idea of a transcendent deity and then relationship to that. That was in the Gita, but as Krishna said, but I wanted to keep this more down to earth and how you relate, you know, in a social way.
Great.
Am I right in saying that all of these Eastern approaches, none of them seem to have the concept of a personal God, but they have a concept of merging with God consciousness, which is sort of like, now, the closest exception to that would be the Gita with the Krishna. And my question on that is, are those considered real? In other words, do they have like an eternality? And are they, do they exist on some plane?
Yes. And Brahman is the all of reality, all of creation, all of God, the Godhead, and of those religions that we talked about, I guess that one, you know, has to do most with that. The Confucians and the Taoists talk about heaven or the mandate of heaven, and we translate heaven as God. But Buddhism is a philosophy. It doesn't. Buddha doesn't say he was God or a manifestation of a deity, and he doesn't say, say anything about deity. You're right. It's mainly a way of living, a way of philosophy. It's a philosophy more than a religion.
When you were talking about Buddhism, I thought you mentioned the self not changing. Right?
Yes, the self does change.
Oh, okay, it does change. Okay, so.
Yeah.
When you were describing Arjuna on the battlefield, it struck me for the first time tonight that the more we find out about the mind, there's no one, you know, one little man out there in your mind. that he is, you could see that as a psychological scenario where you're choosing this small group against all these hundred other, you know, impulses and thoughts and so forth.
Arjuna is us. Yeah. We are him, you know. We have to make those existential choices every day.
Okay, lady in the red, right there.
Yeah, going back to Gandhi, you had a statement in there about Western liberalism, and then the Gandhi thought it went from here to here to here to here to here. Could you repeat that?
Yes, he felt like, you know, Western liberalism is good, you know. However, individual freedom and liberalism is going to lead to capitalism, free enterprise. But with capitalism, you're going to have those that can accumulate wealth, those haves and have-nots. And the more you have of the haves and have-nots, it's going to subvert democracy. So consumerism and capitalism sows its own seeds of destruction, more or less, for liberal democracy.
Carl, two more questions in the wing.
The common theme through them all was for others. And living for others.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's the universe or you even said for the city of Dallas, but all of them living for others. The philosophy of altruism, which is also the philosophy of the Western religions.
Yeah.
But it seems to me history has proved out that once government institutes that, whether it's Stalin for the greater good, a few people need to be killed, we need to do this. Castro, Cuba, for the greater good, here's the way we need to run this thing. Hitler, for the greatest good, here's the way. But the United States was the first country that said, no, you the individual, your right to your life, your liberty, your happiness. Isn't that the major break that has brought us all of this?
It should be. But look where the United States is going. I mean, we have the haves and the have-nots, and the Democrats against the Republicans, and the this against that, labor and management. I just took a course on some other history, and about the Han Empire in Japan, I mean in China, was coexisted with the Roman Empire at its height, their government was an entirely different way. It was Confucian mostly, and they had a big bureaucracy, about the same number of people, about 55 million people, but about 140,000 bureaucrats. Of every kind of level, but it was a meritocracy. You had to pass the exams. You had to go through the examination and be, you know. And so they were all Confucians, and they all, you know, did their duty virtuously, the right way. None of them supposedly were took money or whatever. And so their civilization lasted just as long as the Roman one, about 400 years. But it was an entirely different way of governing. And I guess, you know, if we have a government of philosophers, like, you know, Aristotle said, or Plato said, or, you know, if we're all Confucians, it might be different, but we're humans. Like you say, and humans tend to accumulate wealth. What's mine is mine, and what's yours I'm going to take away if I can. I guess we're all going to always, it's never going to be a good world. It's never going to be a perfect world.
One more question. Last question. Yes, the lady right here.
I guess the biggest question I have from hearing about the Eastern Bloc is sort of comparing what was said to the existentialist movement of Western philosophy, like, you know, the search for the meaning of life through sort of more metaphysical, like, trying to understand epistemology and, like, the roots of what is the ultimate meaning of life versus what seems to be Eastern philosophy, more an emphasis on just the experience, which I feel like Western philosophy would sort of not think of as legitimate because it's just an experience. It stops being like, you know, an intellectual philosophical search at that point. And I'm just sort of trying to bridge the gap.
So what?
I'm just trying to bridge the gap between
okay.
How to understand.
I didn't go into some of the Western thinkers, but Nietzsche, for example, is a postmodernist, and he takes a really big thing against modern consumerism and capitalism and that sort of thing, and says to live an authentic life, live your life as if it were a novel, and you were the protagonist. So he's kind of a Taoist, you might say. So that's where, you know, the postmodernists on the Western part of culture, philosophy, kind of have come toward the East.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Elke. And please come by and see our visitors from